Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. This weekend, Fort McHenry celebrates Defenders Day, the successful defense of the city from British bombs bursting in air in 1814, and the penning of the poem that became the Star-Spangled Banner. There's another element of Fort McHenry's illustrious history worth exploring now, 100 years after some of the most brutal battles of World War I. Fort McHenry was the site of America's largest receiving hospital, where more than 32,000 wounded soldiers and sailors were treated. The National Park Service, which operates Fort McHenry National Monument and Historic Site, has put together a wonderful exhibit about General Hospital No. 2, which operated from 1917 to 1923. With us to share some of the highlights is Gregory Weidman, curator of both Fort McHenry and Hampton National Historic Site. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Sheila. I'm delighted to be here.
Fort McHenry and its predecessor had existed on Locust Point since the Revolutionary War with just an infirmary. Why was it decided to locate a major hospital there?
I think for similar reasons to why Baltimore was such a thriving city during the late 18th and 19th century is that it had an ideal geographic location. Of course, we have a deep water harbor, direct access down the bay for ships coming in, but also Baltimore was a railway hub with connections all over the country. All those factors made it an ideal location, centrally located, if you will, in the East Coast for receiving ships coming back from the European front.
Just before World War I, what was going on at Fort McHenry?
I believe at that time it was a park and managed by the city. It was not an active fort at that time, but with the beginning of the war in 1917, basically the Army reclaimed it for use as the site of a U.S. Army hospital.
And when we talk about the hospital, it wasn't just one big building, right?
No, indeed. It's really quite remarkable. There were, of course, the old Star Fort and a few former military buildings on the site.
That we still see today.
Some of them. But what was so remarkable is they took this fairly open site and within a very short period of time built dozens upon dozens of purpose-built buildings so that by the next year, by 1918, there were over 100 buildings located on the site of Fort McHenry. Numerous wards and operating rooms and barracks, recuperation wards, practically everything you can think of. The Red Cross had a huge building, and other service organizations like that had buildings to serve the soldiers who were recuperating there.
When you say a very short time, how do you know that?
Well, it's very interesting. One of our wonderful things in our museum collection are a series of over 40 large panoramic photographs. By large, I mean 4 feet wide by about a foot tall. And they were taken by a professional photographer to chronicle the building of all these buildings. And you could see a particular view. One of my favorites shows several buildings, the foundations being laid out in January of 1918. Then by February, with snow on the ground, there several of them are all framed in. And by March, they're completed, including covered walkways that ran through the whole fort. So literally, these buildings were going up several at a time in a 2-month period. And of course, this is without means like the sophisticated mechanical equipment that we have today. So it was really quite a remarkable endeavor.
How was Hospital No. 2 staffed?
There was a very large staff, if you can imagine that. Over the course of the war, 32,000 soldiers and sailors were treated there. There were over 1,000 medical personnel, which of course includes trained doctors, nurses' aides, physical therapy aides, medical corpsmen. It was a huge staff that was necessary to staff.
And where did they come from?
Well, certainly some came from Baltimore. Of course, we're a great medical community here. But actually, the doctors and nurses came from all over the United States. One of the chief physician for a while was actually a very chief surgeon was actually a very prominent doctor from New York City. People from all over the country responded to the call for volunteers, so that the staff were from all over the country.
When they started the hospital in 1917, did they have a vision of how big it would be? I mean, the war had been going on for several years in Europe, even
right.
though the U.S. had not been part of it.
Certainly, there were architects involved and planners involved in laying out the site. One of the really interesting items in the exhibit is a very large watercolor architect's rendering, as if it were a bird's eye view of the point and the fort, showing the plan and the location of all these buildings. So since they started going up very quickly, I'm sure the design was probably done originally in 1917, and then the building started very quickly.
You point out how the mission of the hospital changed.
It did. In the beginning, it was principally a receiving hospital, and often then the wounded military men who were in service were possibly sent to other existing facilities. But as time went on, General Hospital No. 2 itself became renowned as an important surgical center and also as a center for both physical therapy and occupational therapy. The doctors at the fort really became considered to be doing groundbreaking work in the treatment of very severe war wounds, particularly what a type of surgery they call maxillofacial surgery, sort of the precursor of what we think of as plastic surgery today. The surgeons there developed techniques that would later become very, very important in non-military surgery.
It's Gregory Weidman, curator of Fort McHenry National Monument and Historic Shrine and Hampton National Historic Site, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She put together the exhibit in the Visitor Center about Fort McHenry's role as a major hospital during World War I. You highlight a quotation from one of the nurses at General Hospital No. 2, Emily Rain Williams, who described the effort, quote, "to recreate out of the wreckage of war clean, whole, and useful men," close quote. Tell us about that work.
Well, I think that's really a wonderful quote. We are very fortunate to have in our collection Emily Rain Williams' memoirs. But the idea of whole meaning not just physically whole, but emotionally whole and having a future to look forward to. That's why one of the most innovative things, in addition to the surgical practices about the fort, was an extraordinary emphasis on both physical therapy, post-surgery physical therapy, but also occupational therapy. There was a truly remarkable number of training programs and shops available on site at the fort itself to offer a wide range of opportunities for the recuperating servicemen to learn trades, to help them in their lives after the service. These trades ranged from traditional things such as cabinet making and boat building to automobile repair and mechanics, telegraphic training, accounting, things that we think of today as sort of standard occupational training. But I've just mentioned a very few. There were dozens of different programs and training opportunities that were available. There were also, of course, physical therapy, and one of the big, big ways that the fort did this was through sports. There was a Fort McHenry baseball team, and it competed with teams from other hospitals in the area and in the region. There were track and field teams that sort of idea of making someone whole through having all these opportunities, both to recover physically and mentally, and have a profession, professional opportunities to look forward to when they left. And we might take this for granted today as something that would be available, but it was very innovative at the time of the First World War.
In addition to the sports, how did they keep up morale?
They had what I consider an absolutely astonishing number of social activities and programs available. The Red Cross was very, and other service organizations were very, very active at the fort. There was a theater, they would show movies, they would have plays, they regularly had dances. There was even a facility down in Anne Arundel County on the Severn River called Camp Purnell, named after the first commandant of the hospital, where during the heat of the summer, some of the recuperating patients could get out of town and go take a swim in the river and take a break from the city heat. So just like all these sporting activities, there were numerous other kinds of activities at the hospital that were made available.
They put out a newspaper, the patients?
Yes. One of the vocational activities was becoming a printer. And so there was a print shop, and the print shop put out a weekly newspaper called, and it's sort of an odd name, called the Trouble Buster. But they put out the Trouble Buster to keep both the staff and the patients informed of all these different activities and things that were available and news flashes. It was really a kind of all-purpose in-house communication system.
The name Trouble Buster makes a little more sense with the image you have, one of the covers.
Yes.
of a wounded soldier with kind of a mixed expression on his face. He's clearly got a facial injury and still is bandaged.
He has a bandage across his forehead.
But he's holding a baseball bat and gonna try.
He's recuperating and getting his activities, and that was, looking at the whole person and what they needed to recover from the grievous wounds a lot of them had suffered.
Part of what they were dealing with is what we call PTSD, what they called shell shock.
Yes. Shell shock was something that was beginning to be recognized. That's the term that they were using in that period because, of course, it was trench warfare, and there was a lot of very lengthy and extraordinarily difficult conditions when the soldiers were being bombarded by artillery on a regular basis. And the men that came back with shell shock, Fort McHenry also had facilities specifically to treat what we would today call psychiatric patients. Again, the physical therapy, the activities that were available, the training programs, those were all considered helpful and part of the psychiatric therapy that was provided. And again, this was pretty innovative for the time period.
How did the influenza pandemic of 1918 affect Fort McHenry?
Oh, it was truly terrible because it just happened to coincide with a period in the early fall of 1918 when there was a huge influx of wounded soldiers from the front. And at one point during the height of the epidemic, I believe in October of 1918, they were losing as many as 10 patients per day. Plus, they were also losing some of the medical personnel and the Red Cross personnel. They were, of course, not immune to this terrible influenza epidemic. So they even had to, at one point, use the chapel as a temporary morgue because the hospital morgue was literally full.
As you said, the armistice was signed in November 1918, but
right. The
hospital continued for years.
It did. It continued, though I believe it was in 1920, the management was shifted over to the U.S. Public Health Service from the Army. But the facility of the hospital itself continued in use until the last patient was discharged in 1923.
Thank you for sharing this history with us.
Thank you, too.
Gregory Weidman is curator of Fort McHenry National Monument and Historic Shrine and Hampton National Historic Site. She put together the exhibit in the Visitor Center about Fort McHenry's role as a major hospital during World War I. She's scheduled to speak about it at noon and again 3 p.m. tomorrow and Sunday. The park is also hosting many daytime family and children's events to celebrate the 204th anniversary of the defense of Baltimore. Kids can enlist as a soldier in the War of 1812, practice military drills, try on 1814-style uniforms, and visit Army barracks. We've got links to information about it all and to any weather-related updates of the weekend schedule at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break now, and then a Stoop Story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.